You're listening to the Thoroughbred Post on the Equisport Radio Network. Brought to you by Ballyrose, your full-service South Florida farm and bloodstock agency. And now from Ballyrose Farm, here's our host Les Saltzman.
At Garden State Park, 40,000 racing fans are out for the Trenton Handicap. And they're off. Three horses, a small field, but a big event in turf history. The three are Bold Ruler, Gallant Man, and Round Table, three of the top-ranking three-year-olds of the year. Gallant Man was favored, Bold Ruler out front. Horse of the Year honors await the winner of the Mile and a Quarter Classic, and it looks like Wheatley Stables' Bold Ruler, winner of the Preakness. Eddie O'Carroll has one of the easiest rides of his life. It was a romp all the way. Gallant Man and Round Table are a couple of also-rans. Bold Ruler, Horse of the Year.
And trained by the immortal Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons. And this morning, we're joined by two of his grandsons, Fred and Bill. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we wanted to do this segment for quite a long time because as years pass, people kind of lose touch with the history of our sport. And your grandfather, he shaped the way training is conducted today. In reading some of the things that we've read over the years, he was so far ahead of himself as in his training techniques. And while the rest of the world was still doing cowboy type of training, your grandfather was more of a cerebral type of trainer. And I think, if you can, share with me, because I think that's how he was as a person, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I'll let Bill take the lead on this. Sure. Well, my grandfather treated the horses the same as he treated his grandchildren. He used to say, don't let him get away with much. And he grew up with horses, starting really at age five when they built a racetrack around the family farm. And it was the grandfather of Winston Churchill, Leonard Jerome, who actually bought my great-grandfather's farm, and they turned that into part of the track. My grandfather, the story goes, liked the horses, the workhorses that were used to build the track, and they had the finish line right near the family barn. And my great-grandfather and the family were allowed to live on the farm while the track was under construction. And my great-grandfather was paid by Jerome to board the workhorses. So at the end of the day, pretty much every day, my grandfather got a ride on one of the tired old workhorses as they went past the finish line and into the barn. And much later, in an interview, he chuckled and said, there were a lot of great riders of the day, but I always remember that I was the first one to ride a horse past the finish line at Sheepshead Bay Racetrack. Of course, it was before they started. So he had a sense of humor, but he worked hard. He really knew horses, and he knew horses because he worked with them from a very early age.
So that and he had a career as a trainer that lasted 69 years, which is an amazing thing.
Yes, yes. He started as a jockey. Started actually in 1889. He was an exercise boy for the famous Dwyer brothers.
So that would have made him 15 years old, right?
I'm sorry?
So he started galloping when he was about 15.
When he was 15, he was an 84-pound 15-year-old exercising horses for the Dwyer brothers. And the trainer came up to him and said, Fritz, what would you think of actually riding in a race? And he said, sure. But he thought, you know, someday. But the trainer said, okay, you're in the fifth race today. So they didn't even have an outfit small enough for him. They had to tuck something in. But he finished fourth, and he was disappointed. But the trainer said, oh, that was great. I didn't expect the horse to do that well. And he wasn't too far off the pace. So after that, he said, I considered myself a jockey. But go ahead.
No, and he rode for what, 5 or 6 years as a race rider, right?
Well, he actually rode until 1900. But what he did in 1890, this political boss in Gloucester, New Jersey, William Thompson, who the papers sarcastically referred to as the Duke of Gloucester because he was so powerful in New Jersey. He opened a racetrack in Gloucester, and for 3 years, it ran practically every day. Forget about what weather it was. And it was one of the first tracks labeled an outlaw track by the Jockey Club because they didn't like winter racing, and they didn't like some of the other things they did, because they considered it a sport. But my grandfather used to say, well, it's very nice, that they want to have racing only a couple of months a year, but I need to feed my children every day. So he did that. He became a jockey at the outlaw tracks, and he even was a jockey for several real outlaws, including Frank James of the Jesse James gang and Dick Little, who was also in the Jesse James gang. But after they were let out of prison, they became pretty wealthy men and owned racehorses. So, and it wasn't by 18. And he met my grandmother in Gloucester, and they were married in 1892. By 1894, racing was banned in New Jersey. So Thompson, the Duke of Gloucester, he opened a series of tracks in Maryland, just across the border from Delaware. And my grandfather raced there. But he was getting heavy, and pretty much he was only able to race in what they called Cook's races, another sarcasm, right, meaning, you could be a little heavier. And he less and less was able to ride. So by 1894, he was not only training, usually for himself, but he was buying horses for $50 a horse, and he ran them over and over again. If he could find one that would win routinely, then, as he said, there was pork chops on the Fitzsimmons family table. So by 1894, he was training and owning more than he was riding. But he actually rode until 1900.
It's interesting that he went to the smaller track, made a living, and in doing my research, he was so family-oriented.
Yes.
And I think he probably would have worked 48 hours a day if he needed to put food on the table and make sure everybody was going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And your grandmother, from what I understand, was kind of the perfect accomplice to that.
Yeah, she was tough. She was a very gritty woman who moved with him in the early years. As he went from track to track, with the result that each of my four oldest uncles were born in a different state because she went with him. and you know, whatever it took. Whatever it took. Go ahead.
It's interesting to note that my grandfather, he got married to my grandmother when he was 18 years old. And, yeah, they had six children. And they really didn't have a permanent home until about 1913. This is after my grandfather started to make some good money as a trainer. But otherwise, he was a vagabond going from track to track with his wife and five of the six children. My father was the last. He was born in 1909. By that time, they were close to being stabilized. But he would always remark it was a hell of a way to make a living. And it hurt his family. But really, by moving from town to town, that was his way of life. And in 1913, he got a house in Sheepshead Bay, and he had that till he died. And that was 1966. So,
right, he was in Miami when he passed. Am I correct?
He did. He went to home in Miami, but his permanent home was in Brooklyn in Sheepshead Bay. So he would spend the winters down in Miami with the Hialeah, starting in 1935. But Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn was his home. He also had another house close to Aqueduct Racetrack, where he spent a good bit of his time so he'd be close to the horses. So when I was growing up, I lived right across the street from him, and we really didn't see him too much except on Sundays, which at that time was a day off at the races. But he was totally devoted to his horses, and you say, what was his secret? He loved his horses. And he wanted to make sure they were fit, and he would not run them unless they were fit. And he didn't care about the money. So that was his kind of credo.
And that's probably why he had such great long-term success.
Yeah, you know, well, he'd always say his secret was good horses and good bosses.
Right.
Now, you know, you talked about Sheepshead Bay, and having grown up part of my life in New York and in Brooklyn, that was always kind of a special place because it wasn't like the rest of New York. Now, is that where you guys grew up?
We all grew up in Sheepshead Bay. The Fitzsimmons family landed in Sheepshead Bay in 1854. Came over on a ship called the Chaos. And Sonny Jim's father was five. And his father had a brother, James, who died on the way over, who was three, and my grandfather was named after him. But, the family lived for generations in Sheepshead Bay, and my grandfather actually bought houses for practically everybody. When my parents were married, my grandfather had a house built across the street from them, and we lived next to my uncle, who was also there, and there was another uncle living in the big house where my grandfather lived, and he also had a house built for his siblings, who lived right next door to him. His mother died early. His mother died in 13, and so that was tough, and it was a hardscrabble life for them. So he tried to keep family close and take care of people. And during the Depression, of course, he actually owned the 1930s. He won just about everything, two Triple Crowns, almost three, and one by one, his brothers, his cousins, his children lost their jobs because of the Depression, and pretty much all of them went to work for my grandfather. So he held everything together for a long time.
That's kind of like a true Brooklyn story, isn't it? Where people are taking care of their family, and especially in those days. And I understand that at one point one of you guys wanted to go to the racetrack, and he said you can do that, but you have to go to college first.
Well, and my father was kind of the black sheep because he was the only one who didn't make a living out of the racetrack. But my grandmother wanted at least one of her children to become a college graduate, so he became an engineer. He only really worked on the track for a short time. He came up with polio in high school and took a year off, and he was made the groom for Dice in 1927. And Dice was champion 2-year-old, won 5 in a row, but unfortunately he got injured and had to retire. So, but my father, I think he would have liked to have been a trainer. But that wasn't to be. My grandmother was in charge.
So she was kind of the boss of the kids, huh?
Yeah, she was a strong person. She had some issues growing up. Two of her siblings died of scarlet fever, and there were a variety of things that happened, and she really became an iron woman. My mother used to have a saying. She said there used to be wooden ships and iron women, and now it's the other way around. But the truth of the matter is my grandmother was an iron woman.
Well, she had to be good.
I'd like to say my grandfather really put a lot of emphasis on education. And we wanted all his grandchildren to be educated and push very hard. And yes, he would always say, you want to get to the racetrack, go to school first. Then when you graduate, he says, you're too smart to go to the racetrack. Go to work.
Now most of you guys, what was there, 16 or 18 grandchildren?
17. You're talking the number 17, Bill, and I'm 16.
You're the
kid.
Yeah,
I'm the baby.
In the group. So
I'm 77, but I'm still the baby.
Good.
Yeah, so.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Wow. Bill was saying he's the baby, and he is.
Yeah.
He's the baby, but he's almost 80. So that's why
it was so important for me to get you guys on, because you know this story is so cool. You know let's talk about the summer getaway. That's why I brought up the grandchildren. Every summer, you guys kind of snuck off, right, to Desolation Island.
There is an island which Fred owns, but it's called Lake Desolation.
Okay.
It is 15 miles northwest of Saratoga. My grandfather used to go up there with my grandmother and picnic and whatever, and they eventually bought some property and built a house. And then my grandfather said, okay, anybody else who wants to build a house here, I'll carve out some property and you can build a cabin. So that's what happened, and we had put up a sign that said Simmonsville, and that's where we spent every summer.
And some of the things that I've read, it was a blast, and it was really good for him too, wasn't it, in his latter years?
Well, it gave him a chance to, it gave all of us a chance to get to know our relatives, and in his case, his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So, and he was a storyteller. He liked to tell stories. So, yeah, he enjoyed that a lot. And, I think that's why he bought the property. In fact, in his will, he left enough money to keep the thing going for about 40 years before we wound up selling the property to different family members who still live up there.
Lake Desolation is kind of like a small Lake George. It's cool, clear water, but it's very hard to get to in the earlier days. It's up on the top of a mountain, and it wasn't.
You don't get there by accident.
They had electricity. Yeah. So my grandfather went up there in the 20s, and that was his escape to get out of the hot Saratoga, and that long before they had air conditioning. So he used to go up for daily visits or weekly visits with the family, and then in 1939 he finally built his first cabin, and as Bill mentioned, other cabins grew up around him, and that became the place to go in the summer for us growing up. And I grew up during the time that summers in the cities were unbearable, and you didn't have air conditioning. And going up to Lake Desolation, it was in the 40s or 50s in the hot summer days at night, and that was
beautiful. That must have been great.
Yeah.
Well, I used to, as a little kid, I spent the whole day in the water, I think, either fishing or swimming. So it was idyllic in many ways.
And
my wife up there.
Really?
And then
you want to tell us how, or would that embarrass both of you?
I'm sorry?
I said, you want to tell us how you did that, or would that embarrass you?
Oh, how I met my wife? Well,
yeah.
I had a cousin, an older cousin, whose wife died. They had five young children. So they brought up a couple of girls to babysit. And one of them attracted my eye. So we've been married 52 years now. So, we like going to Lake Desolation. We have a house now on Saratoga Lake, actually near Lake Lonely. So we like to tell people we met at Lake Desolation, but we'll probably die at Lake Lonely.
It sounds to me like both of you guys have that famous Fitzsimmons sense of humor, because everybody, from what I hear, everybody loved your grandfather.
Yes.
He could sit around and tell stories,
and
everybody would hang out with him.
Grew up with quips. Yeah. He always had something to say. Often sarcastic. I may have mentioned that when he was 15, he weighed 84 pounds. When I was 15, I weighed 150. So at the track one day, I said, "Well, Grandpa, maybe I could become a jockey someday." And he stops and turns to me and says, "Bill, if they ever start racing elephants, I'll give you a call." So he was tough that way. And one time, too, I said, "Why don't you ever use Johnny Sellers? He's the best jockey around, and you never use him." He said, "Bill, if you ever see a jockey carry a horse around the track, you call me, and I'll hire him." You know, you couldn't tell him much, because he was there already. He knew everything. So, but it was fun.
Now, can we touch on something that's a little sensitive? And something that's bothered me for a number of years. A movie was made of Seabiscuit.
Yeah, Seabiscuit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
well,
if there was any ever a mischaracterization of somebody, it was in that movie.
Yes, but there's a little bit of truth in it.
A little bit of truth there?
Yeah, but the trouble with Seabiscuit as a 2-year-old was he just refused to work out. He's a very lazy horse, in the sense that most horses, you get them up in the morning, they can't wait to get out and run around. Seabiscuit was not that way. And it got to the point that my grandfather said, the only thing that seemed to get him excited to run and race is if another horse challenged him. So he would try to work out with another horse, but then he decided, well, he might as well just put him in a race and let him work out that way, because he couldn't work out in the traditional manner. As a result, unbelievably, as a two-year-old, he ran 35 times, starting at Hialeah in January. And people say that was like my grandfather was a Simon Legree as far as Seabiscuit was concerned. But the reality is, that's the only thing that made him exercise. And then the other part of the story was that when he got sold back in August of 1936 as a three-year-old, he had just won three races in a row. And he was starting to find himself for my grandfather. But Mrs. Phipps, who owned the horse, wanted to get some West Coast racing in for one of her stallions, offspring, a stallion being Hardtack. She owned Hardtack, which is an interesting story, the Man of War connection to my grandfather. But anyway,
tell us about that, because that is interesting.
What happened? Well, they sold Seabiscuit for what amounted to be like $150,000 today. And obviously, he won more than a $500,000 and became the nation's sweetheart in the late 30s and won the famous match race with War Admiral. But my grandfather was always in love with Man of War, and his story in connection to Man of War was kind of a sad one. It started out with he was the second, and Phil can fill you in better on this. But when Man of War was auctioned off as a yearling in Saratoga, my grandfather and his patron at the time was the second bidder. And in fact, Phil, maybe you should tell it, because you know better the details about the...
Well, the simple thing was, my grandfather went, and this was the Belmont's dispersal sale. He was getting rid of his entire stock. And Man of War was a one-year-old at Saratoga. My grandfather was there, but the Quincy stable owner, who he worked for, was not there. And when the price got to about $5,000, my grandfather felt, oh, I can't spend this much money on a horse when the owner is not here, because I'm uncomfortable doing that. So he did not get the horse. And he always regretted it. He would talk about it all the time. Now, a year later, a full brother of Man of War came up called Playfellow, and he got Playfellow, but that turned into a fiasco because he was just getting Playfellow into shape when the horse was bought for $100,000 by this guy, Harry F. Sinclair, who, if you may not recognize the name, you may recall from grammar school. The Teapot Dome scandal. He was the one who bribed the Secretary of the Interior to get this Teapot Dome oil reserve. In any event, after Sinclair had the horse for a couple of months, he wanted to give him back to say he was a cribber and a windsucker, which are things that could possibly create problems for racing. And there was a one-year-long legal battle where they eventually had to take the horse back, and my grandfather worked as much as he could, but it was, you know, the horse was out of commission for too long. So so the Man of War playfellow thing, one of the sad stories, like Seabiscuit in my grandfather's racing career.
But there, yeah, but go ahead.
Let me tell you that they Hardtack, which was the sire of Seabiscuit,
right,
was purchased by Mr. Swift. And he wasn't that good at the racetrack, but the Phipps family thought that his Man of War background, it was very hard to get a Man of War stallion at the time because Mr. Riddle didn't allow too many breedings to his great stallion. So the Phipps wanted, they retired Hardtack. They offered him for free service to any mayor, owner of any mayor, and they bred a couple of their female mayors to Hardtack, and Seabiscuit was one of those offspring. And here he was, came out, he and his other another horse that looked exactly like him, named Grog, were two small horses. And they started out, as we started to say about Seabiscuit, he had a you had to really coax him to do any work. And but eventually he became pretty good. So here we are in the 1936 Saratoga season, and Howards wanted to buy him, take him to California. And the Phipps felt that if he went out to California and he did some good, it would enhance their stallion Hardtack, and they could make some more money with horses from Hardtack, and they did in a way. But nevertheless, nobody ever expected Seabiscuit to turn out as good as he was. And when they offered the price, as I mentioned, about $150,000 in today's world, my grandfather said, "Well, he has a bad leg." And $150,000 is probably a fair price, but I want to tell you, he's starting to get good. Well, they sold him, and he very quickly got good. And then the following year, he got even better. And then the year after that, they had the match race with War Admiral, who was Man of War's son, War Admiral. So they had two. A son and a grandson, a Man of War, running against each other that day. So the Seabiscuit won, and my grandfather was rooting hard for him. And in fact, he was down at Pimlico that day, and they let him lead the horse into the winner's circle after the race.
Yeah, that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, and I'm glad you brought that up, because the public perception was that There wasn't that kind of relationship. And from what reading history, you know, your grandfather had a very close relationship with the horse and really cared about it.
My grandfather loved the horse. Just like you would your pet.
Yeah.
So even when they went to a new owner.
Yeah.
Well, having trained myself, You know, in the back of your mind, you're saying to yourself, "I hope he doesn't do better than me." But in your heart, you're saying, "Boy, I took care of this horse for a long time, and I really love this horse, and you know, blah 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 blah." And you're rooting for the horse, you know, and you know whether somebody else is training it or afterwards, you know, you're still jumping up and down as they're going down the lane, snapping your fingers and saying, "Come on, get up," you know, and I'm sure your grandfather was that guy, you know, who really cared about those
ego.
Horses.
He did not have an ego. He was very interested in Seabiscuit afterward. And if you've read the book by Laura Hildebrand, he was very interested and happy that the horse did as well as it's doing. The thing to remember in the background is my grandfather at any given time was training as many as 70 horses. And in 1936, he had the horse of the year, Granville.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We've talked about some horses that have gotten away, but the list of horses that didn't get away, such as Gallant Fox, who won the Triple Crown, Omaha, that won the Triple Crown, Nashua. Here's an interesting thing. So yesterday was the Nashua Stake at Aqueduct, which is a Grade 3. And I manage some racing stables, and one of our two-year-olds won that race. So I thought it was absolutely great that you guys were on the next day. But he had Bold Ruler. You know, and it goes on and on and on with great horses that he had during his career. But he probably, and especially now that I've spoken to you, probably some of those horses that never made black type were some of his favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. If you, there are several articles actually on the lesser horses that got him through the hard years that he loved. And wish we could have a memorial to some of those. But he had a lot of very good horses that he really enjoyed training, and he always had trouble picking the one he thought was the best.
He had a horse named Buoyancy. Probably, I think it was like in the 40s. And he was a promising two-year-old who broke his leg. And my grandfather said he was one of the most gentle horses he ever trained, and he thought that they might be able to put a cast on his legs and have him heal himself. Of course, you know that the reason they can't repair broken legs on horses because the horse will is not a good patient and will always put his foot down and create another crack. But they actually put him in a sling, and they got him to heal to a point that it looked like he might be able to survive the broken leg. But then when he got back into training, it broke again, and they had to put him away. But that's the kind of horse he got associated with that didn't make the black types. But he had a lot of horses over the period of his years. And when I was getting ready for this conversation, I kind of looked back and I said, you know, they didn't start Saratoga until 1863. That was the first public race course in the North. Up until that time, all they had was racing in the South, and because of the Civil War, Saratoga was established so that they could have competitive horse racing that the public could witness. And here he is, born in 1874 in the New York tracks. I think Sheepshead Bay, Coney Island, Gravesend, there's a couple of racetracks in Brooklyn became the early New York City racetracks. So he was there.
And that's the amazing thing, because he was there at the very beginning, and that the beauty of that 69-year career. Could you imagine when he started? They didn't have starting gates, right? They raced from the tape.
Yeah, that's right. And Gallant Fox went from the starting net. They didn't even have gates when he was running. The Preakness was before the Derby in the 1930s. So that's another confusion point that don't quite understand today.
The grandness of his career is fantastic, and I don't. You guys probably know this better than I do, but he was the leading trainer in 1930, and won it again four other times, but the last time, 1955. So 25 years, and he was still a leading trainer. I don't know anybody had that depth of competitiveness in the industry.
Lucas comes close. In fact, Lucas has just passed him a couple of years ago for having the most Triple Crown race winners. My grandfather had 13 Preakness, Belmont, or Derbies as his total. And that was number one for years until Lucas passed him about 3 years ago. And now I think Lucas is up to 15, but 13 is still pretty good. So,
yeah, 13 is real good. But now I want to get back to the family if I can for just a couple of seconds, and then I'll let you guys go. You guys, you know, obviously love the sport. I know your other siblings or family members are still really involved in the sport, but also you guys had great educations and great careers. And again, I think it goes back to a lot of that work ethic that Grandpa had.
Sure. Yeah. He says you got to make your way in life. He helped us out, but he didn't take care of us when we became 21.
Well, you know, he taught you the right way, obviously. And now, do you guys have kids?
Of course.
And grandkids?
We're at that stage. In fact, my oldest grandchild is graduating high school this year. So we're in the process of trying to find a college for him. So, he's not going into the race business.
No. My grandfather always thought the race track was a tough life. And it provided a vehicle for him. But, you know, he wanted everybody to go to college. Yeah.
So, he didn't win, he didn't eat.
That's a heck of a way to live. So,
yeah. Well, he used to have to get up at 4:30 every morning, and he did that until he was 89. And somebody asked him once if there was a way to beat the ponies, and he said, "If I could do that, I'd sleep till noon."
Well, you know, it gets in your blood, and it's a tough thing to stop doing. I'm 70, and we have a farm here, and every morning I'm up at 4:30. And that's the clock is built in. But again, I want to let you go. This was wonderful. This was absolutely wonderful, and I appreciate you guys taking the time. We'll get you the link to it so you can listen to yourselves and share with the family if you'd like.
Wonderful.
Another question. This is an important one. Lundy's, is that still open in Sheepshead Bay? The seafood Lundy's? Restaurant? Yeah.
That's been closed. We all used to go to Lundy's.
It's come back and forth a couple of times, Bill. I haven't been down in Brooklyn for years. I think it's still closed, but I know it. The original Lundy brothers went out of business probably 30 years ago, and it
shows how out of touch I am, right?
It was purchased by the pop singer Teresa Brewer at some point in the early 60s, but then it went out of business again.
The reason I never became a jockey were those biscuits that they served before the...
you obviously know Lundy's, and the pies are unbelievable. The mince pies,
the pies were yard wide.
Well, if I get to meet you guys, we'll have to go someplace and try and find something almost as good.
Where's your farm, Wes?
We're in South Florida.
Oh, actually, yeah, South Florida.
Yeah, actually, we're not too far from Jack's, where Jack stays for the winter. And hopefully he'll come out to the farm.
Okay, so you're on the Atlantic side, not the Gulf side.
Yeah, we're on the Atlantic side.
Yeah.
Right. We're about an hour north of Gulfstream. Racetrack, that's how we tell the directions, right? We say an hour north of the racetrack.
It's too bad you don't have Jack on with us today, but he would plug his the Sunny Jim Racing group that he heads up. You know, we still try to keep Sonny Jim's name in the racing world today. And we have a partnership with only four horses. It's really a public partnership, but most of it is family members. So,
any
listeners
that
are interested, check Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons Racing on your website, and you'll find out all about it.
But even more important, can we give the website, the family website out?
Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons Racing. That's what
I think he's talking about the Fitz book, which is Jimmy Carr's website. Well, that's
been that is what,
we say we invented Facebook before Facebook, but we called it Fitzbook.com. So
Fitzbook.
When Facebook came in and
I have to tell you, since you sent me the link to it, I haven't stopped looking at it. It's like a walk through not only horse racing history, but how America was from the mid-1800s. It's great. And I know it's a family collaboration, and you guys have done just a wonderful job.
Yeah. That's, again, mostly that is our cousin Jimmy Carr, although I think we all contributed to it. You may see when you open it up, there's a picture which was a centerfold. Fred and I were centerfolds in the 1958 Sports Illustrated when they did a thing on my grandfather. And that's,
so you were the first bathing suit edition? Is that it?
It was, no, it was before the bathing suit edition. But I always like telling people I was the centerfold.
Well,
I've won a couple of
for that, and we may put that up on the racing on our website. I think that would be fun, guys. I'm going to let you go. Hopefully, if you don't mind, down the road, we'd like to get you back on again and get some more anecdotes and a little bit more about my favorite trainer. And I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Happy. Always great to talk about my grandfather. There's a lot to talk about. He has lots of phases to his life.
Yeah. Well, let's plan on doing it again. And again, thank you for joining us on the show.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Nice. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's probably one of the more unusual episodes of the Thoroughbred Post.
The finest care for your horses in a quite relaxed natural environment. That's what you will get at Bally Rose Farm in South Florida. Customized feed, therapy, and turnout programs ensure that every horse gets the attention they need and deserve. With more than 35 years of professional experience, the Bally Rose team works hard for you and your horses and is known for its client communications. Turnouts, breeding stock, or layup, Bally Rose is your best choice. Visit ballyrose.com or call 561-774-5200.
And now back to the show. Here's Les.
Owning a championship racehorse is an experience to be cherished, but Mom's Command success was extra special to Peter Fuller. Mom's Command's primary rider was Fuller's daughter, 26-year-old Abigail, who rode the filly to a sweep of Belmont Park's Filly Triple Crown, comprising the Acorn, Mother Goose, and Coaching Club American Oaks.
Looks like Mom's Command can do it. This is going to be a Filly Triple Crown winner. Mom's Command with Abigail Fuller aboard, winning by about 6 lengths. Then Bessarabian is second. It's Mom's Command in front.
Mom's Command entered the 1985 Alabama winless in 2 starts at Saratoga, a second to Lady's Secret in the test stakes, and a fourth in the previous year's Spinaway. Her competition in the Alabama included Kentucky Oaks winner Franz Valentine. Placed on the lead, Mom's Command cruised to a 2.5 length advantage through an opening half mile in an honest 46-4. The speedy chestnut, once thought to have distance limitations, was never threatened by any of her rivals.
Mom's Command continues to lead by 5. Now Franz Valentine once again moves into second, and Foxy Dean is third. A race to the wire with Mom's Command in front.
The Alabama would be the final start for Mom's Command, later named Champion 3-Year-Old Filly for 1985.
Rider and horsewoman, Abby Fuller joins us here on the Thoroughbred Post. Good afternoon, Abby. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon. So sorry. My phone.
That's that high tech stuff. It always gets us, right? Well, it's good to get you on the show. And just before you came on, we were interviewing the grandchildren of Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons.
Wow.
And we were talking about families. And that's why I wanted to get you on with the same episode, because family was so important to you in your career as a rider and a horsewoman. And wanted to jump on that subject with you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So the first time the general public got to see Abby Fuller was in 1968 in the winner's circle of the Kentucky Derby.
That's right. Yeah,
and
I was the youngest of the kids that got to go because I was already a little horse crazy girl. There's 8 kids in my family, 7 girls and a boy. And so my brother's the next one older than me, my 3 older sisters. And then I was the youngest thing to go, so I was thrilled.
So that was exciting. And you had mentioned you were already horse crazy.
Yeah.
By that time.
Yes. Yeah, we all actually, you know, very luckily got to, you know, have an opportunity to riding lessons or go to camp. And I was just the one definitely struck by it, you know, in love with horses, in love with riding, you know, ended up competing and all of that. So, yeah, I was in at the first, you know, whiff of a horse, I would say.
Now, can we talk about your dad for a couple of seconds?
Sure.
So your father, to me, is one of the most interesting owners that I can remember, because he really was a Renaissance man, right? Here's a guy that boxed and did all this stuff in business, and yet he was so socially conscious.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he grew up, you know, his dad was absolutely a self-made guy. My grandfather, who really, he died before, so I didn't know him, but we certainly heard a lot about him. As you said, we're, you know, certainly my mom and dad were very family conscious, and so we heard about, you know, my dad was kind of sickly as a kid and wanted to get strong, and, you know, had to drink milk because he's celiac, and they had goats on the farm, and he would work, you know, driving posts in and doing stuff like that just to build himself up. So he was, you know, the opportunities were there, but he also was pretty self-driven to do that. He was always worked out, and when he was in college, he was, you know, boxing, and it actually, I think his dad wasn't really that into him being a boxer. I think he had thoughts of maybe even turning pro, and his dad was like, you know, thinking that was kind of crazy, given the other opportunities that he had. But he wrestled, and he did all those things, and was also you know, socially conscious. We were brought up that way. And so, yeah, a very interesting guy. And definitely, you know, my dad was someone who did things his way. He was kind of the Frank Sinatra, you know, I did it my way, for sure.
And during that 1968 Dancer's Image Kentucky Derby, and most people are aware, you know, that the horse came down on what was supposedly a positive. And
right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. And I would advise anybody that's listening to do a little research into that whole process, because that was probably as wrong as it gets. And the reasons for it were as wrong as it gets.
Yeah, that was, as we, you know, as certainly any of us who were alive in those times knows, it was a socially upheaval, a time of social upheaval, and certainly Dad, yes, they can certainly Google it, and there's definitely different shows in his own words that he talked about it. You know, I was a kid, but certainly aware of, you know, we all knew about the donation to Coretta Scott King that came from the Governor's Cup in Maryland. And then, you know, had a sense of, even as, you know, the kids, like a sense of, oh, people didn't like that. And Dad had wanted to bring, you know, extra security to Churchill. And they said, oh, no, no, we don't want to do that. That'll, you know, make anything worse. And the year before, of course, Martin Luther King had led a protest at Churchill.
Right.
So, and my dad and mom had met Dr. King and his wife. So, you know, had felt connected to their a just cause. And so, but Dad had done that kind of quietly, and it came out, I think, before the wood, as they were, you know, waiting for time on the TV, the guy actually mentioned it. And so it became a bigger thing probably than it would have been, not that widely known. You know, maybe it was all meant to be. Also, that is how they changed the rules of having split samples, was because of that case, because they only had, you know, they had taken a sample, they said it was tainted, and there was nothing else to test. So from then on, you know, rules were changed. And if I'm not mistaken, that was actually the only year until much later, you know, in more recent times, where Butte was actually illegal
correct,
Kentucky. So it's 100%. A whole, I mean, my goodness, there's so much to it. And I can't claim, and I don't think anyone alive can claim to know exactly how it all did go down. Because, you know, certainly Dad has passed, and Dr. Harthill has passed, and Dad never, you know, did know of, like, well, this is exactly what happened. You know, he believed the horse had received Butte maybe earlier in the week. He had a great trainer, Lou Cavallaris, who, you know, was very, you know, on board with what's going on and knowledgeable and all of that. So, yeah, it was quite a crazy thing, and something
yeah, but
that a lot
but
of
Peter
people
Fuller didn't give
you know,
up. He didn't give
right,
up.
Right? No, he fought.
Walked away.
He won the court case. Yeah, he definitely won the first court case. Kind of thought that would be it, and you know, Mrs. Markey came out and said, you know, if Calumet's not reinstated or instated as the Kentucky Derby winner, we'll never run another horse in Kentucky. That's the story that I was told by my dad. So, and then, so they went back to, I guess, Kentucky Supreme Court, and they were
correct.
Put up, and then Dad was done. He was like, you know, okay, I've spent more than the purse, and, you know.
But any most other people would have walked away from the sport, but not him.
No, not him. He loved it. You know, at one time, probably up till Mom, or a little before Mom's command, he had really loved the gambling part of it, but became more and more. I mean, he was definitely an animal guy, and all had dogs, and, you know, but I think started to get more of a sense of it maybe with me being so involved in it. And, you know, we would talk about, like, horses, and I remember kind of when Monty Roberts came out, Dad was like, what do you think? And so he was a curious guy, and always, but he loved the sport, he loved the competition, he loved the betting, and so, yeah, he was not a give-up guy. He was not a guy, you know, I'm going home with my tail between my legs. He kept breeding, bred a lot of really nice horses, and of course, yeah. And then, you know, Mom's Command was, you know, certainly one of the best of the best.
And, you know, we'll get to the Mom's Command story, but then he switched to Ned Allard as a trainer.
Right.
And one of the other things that really impresses me about your dad is loyalty.
Yeah.
Obviously, tremendous loyalty to have you riding for him, and you know, you won the Philly Triple Crown. You did amazing things on Mom's Command, and he stood with you. But Ned, I think he won about 75 stakes for your family.
Yeah, Ned was great. Yeah. You know, we had Odie Cleland trained for Dad for many years, and Dad always I think very, very early on, I remember him telling me a story about, I don't know if it was maybe even before Charlie Heverly, but a good trainer. And my dad kind of tried to tell him, you know, we should do this and that. And he said, listen, the trainer said, listen, I've trained for Elizabeth Arden. I've rubbed her creams on their legs, but we're not like I will train horses and you will. You know, that he kind of laid down the law, and my dad took that actually, and was a great. I mean, I know Ned and Odie. You know, they had great relationships with him, and he was a loyal guy. And Ned was kind of starting out when they got together, and you know, kind of came along with. You know, Ned also picked up some, you know, nice owners through my dad. And Dad just always, Ned's a great guy. So it's not like you had to really go out on the land to say, hey, you know, check this guy out. I mean, he's not only a good horseman and came up under George Handy and as a kid at Rockingham. And he was in New England, which Dad liked. You know, he had horses at Suffolk and Rockingham.
Well, your dad was really a New England guy. And obviously by your accent, that still stays with you.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely New England guy. And when that racing, you know, they kind of got, I mean, Dad still did race in New York, but he had, you know, people for a long time, Bobby Lake in New York for years and years. You know, Chris and Greg Karen kind of started with Odie, and then, you know, years later, if a horse would go out of town or whatever, that's who, you know, Dad would look to. Again, no slouches. You know, they were great people.
No, you couldn't go wrong with either of them.
Right, right.
But then you came along, and people always just think of you as Mom's Command. But you won a lot of races, a lot of races on other races.
It is funny because people, you know, and of course people that don't know really much about racing, but they'll say, oh, did you ride a lot of other horses? And I'm like, yeah, you know, and it's funny. you know, sometimes to look back, and I do other work now, equine-assisted therapy, and you think of literally having ridden and then been around, known thousands of horses. Because any of us that's worked at the racetrack for any number of years, you know, I came down to Ocala and worked for Norman Cassie at Cardinal Hill, was one of my first galloping jobs, and actually my second. The first one was a guy, Frank Myers, who told me I'd never make it as a jockey. But
and,
anyway.
And being a fuller, that was all you needed, right?
Right. No, for sure. Like, I was like, because we had, you know, of course, I had some rough days. I came from show horsing, and I thought I knew a lot. And then when you throw a leg over those little, you know, baby horses, and they're dropping their head down, and you're like, wait a minute, what's going on? But I never really had thoughts of not doing it. I was like, but this is what I'm going to do. The very first race I ever rode, and that's in air quotes, because it was out at Murdy Farm, and it was in a little Arabian race. And the guy said to me, you know, do you have an overgirth? Or where's your overgirth? And they had to carry like 125 pounds, and I weighed like 95. I said, I don't know, what's an overgirth? I had an exercise saddle because it was heavy. And the horse, so the saddle slipped under the horse on the first turn, and I went off, and my friend had done a little picture journey of it all because she was there from the show horse world. People go like, wow, and you still did it? I'm like, well, of course. Like, I didn't even get hurt. You know, so, yeah.
Now, when he asked you where the overgirth was, were you thinking that the next question was going to be for you to go get the saddle stretcher?
No, so I didn't. Yes, they had done that to me at Suffolk. You know, I got the steam,
okay,
you
so
know,
you got
the bucket
broken
of steam, and
key to the quarter pole and all that kind of stuff.
But and I stupidly, because I had worked one season at Rock before I went to Ocala, but I didn't know. You know, I hadn't really been dialed in on the racing. I mean, I was galloping in the morning. I would walk the hots. I would do all the stuff, putting tack. But I, you know, a lot of stuff I didn't know. And I didn't know that an overgirth would help my saddle stay on in a race. So I did learn that. But yeah, I mean, and you know, my dad didn't really ride me in the beginning. I remember I rode a horse for Ned. I hadn't won a race yet. I'd ridden, I don't know, maybe 10 or 20 races. And he had this horse, nice big horse, probably a little hard for me to ride. He was a big kind of heavy-headed horse, and he was coming back off a layoff, and I was kind of excited, and it's like, I got to take you off. This horse is ready to win. I think partly Ned didn't think I was ready to win, and maybe the owner, which was not my dad, you know, said, hey, do we have to ride this bud girl? I want Gamby. You know, Carl Gambadella, the leading rider,
right.
Of course. So the horse wins, and I tell Ned after a little bit, I said, I'm going to go out and, you know, I can't gallop in the morning for you anymore. I've got to go out and get some milk. And he said, okay. And I walked around for a while and, you know, get a mount here and there. But that was where my first winner came from, a guy, Jimmy Pace, who had a fair amount of horses, and a guy, Mike Mazinski, was his, a lot of people know Jimmy and Mike from New England. And so they gave me a shot on this horse, Gallop Pole, and I ended up winning like 5 on that horse. That was kind of the, you know, but it was a year. I rode my first race in like November or so, October of 82, and I won my first race in July of 83. And I don't think any of the first 5 were for Dad. They were, you know, kind of small-time guys. But once, you know, you get the little bug girl, and Suffolk was always a great place for, you know, giving somebody a shot if you were willing to, you know, gallop in the morning,
up. And those days, they were pretty open to girl riders.
Absolutely, yeah. New England always was. I mean, probably one of the first with Denise, you know, Boudreau, and back and Barbara Smith way, you know, back in the 70s. And they, you know, they kind of promoted it and people liked it. Of course, I mean, there's always some, there's always your guys that tell you, go back in the kitchen. I think every girl rider has a story of that. I do. Yeah. Guys, hey, fella, get back in the kitchen. And I told them I can't cook either. And he, everyone around him, like, poked him, and he started laughing. It was something, you know, that was kind of it. One of the few times I had the comeback ready right away.
And you rode one of my all-time favorite horses.
Who's that?
The Mortgage Man.
Oh, my God. He was. I wrote a poem about him. I loved that horse.
He so I had a staff brother.
Wow. How did you know him?
I had a staff brother.
Okay.
And who actually, quick story, I had him. He had it. Chipped pelvis. We never got a chance to run him, but I loved the family. I just loved
beautiful
the
beautiful family.
And
yeah, it was Tom Rolfe, right?
Yeah,
like classic and, old, yeah, old school bloodline.
Yeah, yep. And I was at Saratoga before I bought Big Bay Cat, and I saw a Mortgage Man, and he wasn't perfectly conformed, but he looked like he could run through anything. Yeah, he just had that look in his face, and but it's interesting that you wrote him, and you know, and then you know, I trained at Parks, and you raced down there a bunch of times, so we got to see you a lot, and you got injured, and then you came back, and we've got to wrap up. I'm going to kind of accelerate us a little bit.
Okay.
You came back, and in true Fuller fashion, you weren't going to give up riding. You know, you came back a couple of times, and then you trained.
Yeah, I came back a bunch of times. It's kind of funny. I did, and I trained. I like training, especially, you know, like for Dad and for a few really good people, but that's a hard job, as you well know. Was for me not as fun as racing, as riding races. You know, the whole climbing thing's hard, the whole, anyway, I loved, you know, still always loved the horses, but that was and then I came back after 9-10 years, I ridden a Lady Legends, and I had a filly at Calder that was a little bit of a little kooky redheaded girl. And,
I remember.
So my dad asked me, yeah, if I could take her on, I did. And then the jock, I actually was riding PJ, not Cooksey, PJ. Oh my gosh. Stupid. Sorry, PJ. PJ Lydon. And she got hurt, and so I said, I should ride her, because I was galloping her. And all my friends, the Gaffneys who I was working with, I'm like, yeah, you should. And my dad was like, why don't you? And my son, and I'm like, okay. And it had been 9 years since I rode a race, and she won. So that was super fun, of course. And then I rode for about 6 months, rode at Gulfstream for the first time, because I'd always stayed up north. So that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so when you rode that time, who's blowing harder, you or the horse?
Probably me. Probably. Okay. Although I did really, I worked it. I tried to be really fit, and she took me along. I mean, she'd run a couple times, and it was a nice, we just got a nice trip, and I kind of had a good feeling the whole way. Probably more nerves for me than maybe actual fitness. I do think I'll truth myself out and say I think I went to the bathroom about 7 times before. The girls were like, are you all right? Said, yeah, I think so. That was nice and light. But anyway, that might be too much information.
I'm going to embarrass you now, okay?
Okay.
Because one of the reasons I wanted you to be on the show and why I think so highly of you is when you had that horse, I remember you literally scrubbing buckets, walking the horse, really being hands-on when you didn't need to. And that, to me, is the checkbox for a horsewoman. And I really admired that hard work that you put in on that horse. I was about 4 or 5 barns down from you. And I'd always see you work really hard.
Yeah.
I appreciate your hands-on and your caring about the horse and just watching you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I did pretty much, throughout my time there at Calder and stuff, I was working kind of alongside Emmy and Ronnie Gaffney, who were great friends from New England. But yeah, I did definitely, I was definitely brought up the right way too with, Ocala and the Bakers and then Ned, it's like you don't just waltz in and get a leg up on a horse, and I'm, grateful for that. That's the same way I was in the show horse world, but of course that's a little different. But racing, yeah, thanks. That's definitely a true story there.
Hey, we've got to go. You're living in Ocala now?
Yes.
And you're doing equine assisted therapy. In 30 seconds, tell us what you're doing.
So I work for a disabled place, and they're actually in Davie. I do to do some more work up here in Ocala, but I travel down there a couple times a month, and the horses are part healing, learning, ghosts, and psychotherapy for clients and kids and people in rehab even. The horses are amazing partners and huge part of the team. And I'm in it. I'm called the equine specialist. I'm not a therapist. So there's a team of like the horse and the therapist. And
horse people really can't be therapists. We can be patients, but not therapists.
The horses are our therapy. That's why so many of us stayed with horses.
Right.
Yep.
Abby, when next time you're coming down, our farm is just outside of Wellington. If you ever want to stop by, please do. It has been a pleasure. And thank you for jumping on at the last minute with phone problems and everything else. And it's a pleasure. And I appreciate
it. Sure, it was my pleasure as well. Thank you very much.
And folks, that's it for another edition of the Thoroughbred Post. We'll be with you in 2 weeks, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thanks a lot.